It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for $100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get $100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit Bartesian.com/cocktail. That's BARTESIAN.com/cocktail.
Psst, how'd you like to listen to .NET Rocks with no ads? Easy. Become a patron. For just $5 a month, you get access to a private RSS feed where all the shows have no ads. $20 a month will get you that and a special .NET Rocks patron mug. Sign up now at patreon.dotnetrocks.com.
Hey, welcome back to .NET Rocks. I'm Carl Franklin.
And I'm Richard Campbell.
And happy autumn season to y'all.
Yeah.
It was Halloween last night after we recorded this.
When we're recording, yeah. But yeah, this is later than that because time shifting.
Right. And we were hoping to get some more stuff. We had Dan Roth on last week.
Yeah.
And we were hoping to get some more, time shifting a few shows ago.
Yeah.
But we were hoping to get this closer to .NET Conf. But, you know, Glenn being, experienced in all things .NET 9, just not just Blazor. We thought we would do a little recap of what they talked about at .NET Conf. So, hey, Richard.
Hey, man. What do you got?
Let's, I think we should just jump into a Better Know Framework, don't you?
Do the thing.
All right. Roll the music.
All right. What do you got?
Well, I kind of have gotten into the habit of looking at trending GitHub repositories.
Okay.
And this one came up. It's called Little Big Mouse.
Oh, cool.
It's an open sourced app designed to enhance the multi-monitor experience on Windows 10 and 11 by providing accurate mouse screen crossover locations within multi-DPI monitor environments.
Nice.
Particularly useful for setups involving a 4K monitor alongside a 1080p monitor.
1080p, yeah. So the scaling thing, the DPI thing happens and your mouse goes a little nutty.
Yeah, not just the mouse, but there's a video right there on the repo.
Yeah.
And he takes like Notepad and tries to drag it between the two screens. Yeah, and that's always a not fun experience, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff. I'm going to use it.
Well, this recording rig, I have a portrait-oriented like 1440 screen and then a landscape oriented curved like 38 and dragging between those can get wacky.
Wacky. Yeah. So I'm going to download this too, cause I've got a few screens and I got a 49 incher like you.
Yeah.
And a couple other screens. All right. So that's what I got, Richard. Who's talking to us today?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1903, the one we did with our friend Beth Massey, when we talked a bit about Maui and Blazor.
Yeah.
And got a bunch of good comments on this show because we had a lot of fun there. And this comment is from Ilfeb, who said, I love your shows. My feeling when hearing all these UI names like WPF, WinUI 3, Maui, WebView 2, CSS, that we devs would love to have not so many different UI tech stacks. The fact that still WPF seems to be the most used .NET UI framework tells quite a story at Microsoft's .NET UI strategy in the past. We're using Avalonia for our cross-platform development, which we've done a show on Avalonia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We would love to get such a thing from Microsoft, but now that Avalonia UI is there, I hope that the current wild pace of adoption keeps going. So there's two things that worry me. The current and future, quote, mess, sorry, with .NET UI frameworks, where we could have just one for desktop, mobile, potentially WASM, and a cross-platform form for Windows, Linux, Mac OS, iOS, Android, and the browser. And an unclear cross-platform IDE strategy. I'm very much into Visual Studio, not at all into VS Code. I guess most devs would want VS 2028 to be a cross-platform IDE. What are your thoughts on this?
Did you say 2028?
Yeah, like the next version of Visual Studio. He's
okay.
I mean, and to be clear,
you skipped over a couple of years there.
Yeah, Visual Studio runs exactly on one platform, Windows. There was a Visual Studio for the Mac, which was actually Mono Develop when they got acquired Xamarin. They renamed it, which I thought was an unwise thing to do, but now they've stopped working on it. So that's really not a thing.
Yeah.
I think your wish is a good wish. It's also never been achieved by anything, right? To have desktop, mobile, you know, and plus all of the operating systems that it just works. That would be awesome.
And Blazor.
Well, sorry, I mean, Ed. And Maui is obviously, you know, origins are in Xamarin forms, the phones being the sort of subset that you need to start with and work out from. But it's really hard to start with that set and then do a good job on Windows and Mac OS and the larger screen platforms. So I think it's still a story arc here. Maui's intent was to try and unify all of these things, right? And yeah, I think what you're feeling, your concerns are reasonable because what you're really feeling is that somewhat of a political struggle going on inside of Microsoft about what folks want to work on, who's won what where. Like, there's a lot going on all of this.
I got to tell you, I just wrote an app in Maui for myself because, you know, I'm a solo artist and I play out with my guitar. And I've got sheets of paper, usually, with big song lists and some lyrics, and usually they're like on the floor by the end of the night. And I was like, you know, I got an iPad.
Totally normal playlist thing to happen.
Yeah, I'm like, I got an iPad. Let's do this. So I went looking to see if there were apps out there, and there are.
Yeah.
But they want $30-$40 a month for a freaking list.
A month?
Yeah, or something. I don't know. They were just expensive. Like, I'm not giving you my money for that stupid thing.
What's wrong with Notepad?
So anyway, I wrote an app, and it's beautiful. And here's the thing. Like, my machine is really fast. Faster than my iPad. So I put like a DevExpress HTML editor in there.
Right.
And on my machine, I can add songs and edit, add lyrics and stuff. And then I buzz it over to the iPad and it just reads the data.
Yeah.
You know, and I used it on the gig last night.
Nice.
And it ran Works like a champ.
Fun. Yeah.
So I love that whole Blazor hybrid thing because I could take that and run it in the browser too.
But I'd also say you were putting it on one platform, an iPad.
Two. Run it in Windows
on
my desktop and then iPad. Yeah.
Okay. Legit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the struggle.
The browser's pretty cross-platform.
Yeah. The struggle for a unified cross-plat story is hard. And there's always going to be an origin platform that's going to be strongest, and they're going to battle to make the other ones good. And, you know, folks come from a lot of different directions. So there's a reason you're feeling a little concerned. And I'm glad you're happy with Avalonia. We thought it was an impressive product.
Yep.
Maybe we got to do another show on it. That's very fair.
Maybe.
So Ilfab, thank you so much for your comment. And a copy of Music to Go By is on its way to you. And if you'd like a copy of Music to Go By, write a comment on the website at .NETROCKS.com or on the Facebooks. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, we'll send you a copy of Music to Go By.
Or if you want to just buy Music to Code By, go to musictocodeby.net.
Crazy.
All right. Well, before we start here, this is episode 1925. And as always, I kind of like to run down a little history. You know,
what's your favorite piece of history from 25?
Some events. Well, Mussolini. In January, makes a pivotal speech in the Italian Chamber of Deputies, which will be regarded by historians as the beginning of his dictatorship.
Awesome.
Yeah. Here's a happy note. January 27th to February 1st, the 1925 serum run to Nome, the Great Race of Mercy, relays diphtheria antitoxin by dog sled across the U.S. territory of Alaska to combat an epidemic. How right. about that?
So they ran the drugs by dog sled to get
by
there
dogs.
There's no other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
March 18th, tri-state tornado, the deadliest in U.S. history, rampages through Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana, killing 695 people and injuring 2,027.
That's crazy. But that's before there was ways to warn folks, really.
Right. Yeah.
There's just the sirens.
Yep. So there's more to that. But in April 10th, F. Scott Fitzgerald publishes The Great Gatsby in New York.
Ooh. Famous book.
April 16th, a communist assault on St. Nedelia Church claims roughly 150 lives in Sofia, Bulgaria, a place we have been several times.
Yeah, and at that time was part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. June 13th, American engineer Charles Francis Jenkins achieves the first synchronized transmissions of pictures and sound using 48 lines and a mechanical system in the, quote, first public demonstration of radio vision.
Nice.
Radio
48p.
Yeah.
not 480p, 48p.
July, the Scopes trial, right? In a staged test case, the monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee. John T. Scopes, a young high school science teacher, technically arrested on May 5th and indicted on May 25th, is accused of assigning a reading from a state-mandated textbook on Darwinian evolution in violation of a Tennessee state law, the Butler Act. He is found guilty and fined $100 through the verdict, though the verdict is later overturned on a technicality. The trial makes explicit the fundamentalist slash modernist controversy within the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, with William Jennings Bryan, who dies on July 26, being challenged by the liberal Clarence Darrow. All right, I swear to God, I'm not going to go through all these, but July 18th, Adolf Hitler publishes Mein Kampf. August 8th, the Ku Klux Klan demonstrates its popularity by holding a parade with an estimated 35,000 marchers in Washington, D.C.
Yikes.
August 31st, Margaret Mead, anthropologist, lands in American Samoa to begin 9 months of field work that will accumulate in her 1928 book, Coming of Age in Samoa. This best-selling book will become the first popular anthropological study and will change many attitudes toward tribal peoples. The Locarno Treaties, negotiated October 5th through 16th and signed in London December 1st. Getting ready for World War II here.
Yeah.
Grand Ole Opry, November 28th, first broadcast on WSM Radio in Nashville, Tennessee, as the WSM Barn Dance.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was an interesting year. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah. Hitler's out of prison, publishes Mein Kampf, reforms the Nazi Party, and creates the SS all in the same year.
Yeah.
Guess which way we're going, friends? Right? Like, just like that. He's right back on the mission. 9 months in prison didn't seem to dissuade him much after the beer hall push.
So you're saying he was a convicted felon?
He was, actually.
Hmm.
But it apparently let out. I mean, it was a 5-year sentence. He only served 9 months.
Yeah.
I don't know how you pull that off. That's
friends and
good behavior because he's busy writing a book.
Friends in high places, I guess.
Something. I don't think he had any, actually.
Okay. Enough of that. Let's bring on our guest. Glenn Condren is a program manager on the application platform team at Microsoft, where he spends most of his time working on the ASP.NET Core runtime. Before becoming a PM, he was software developer and consultant for 8 years. His work before Microsoft was primarily for Australian government clients. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're good.
Doing great.
Excellent.
Glad to have you.
You guys have been busy.
Yeah, indeed. I guess my updating of my bio, I suppose, because I probably haven't done it for a while. I am now the lead of the .NET platform team, PM team.
Okay.
Which means that almost everything that's not tooling and MAUI.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All those PMs are mine.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's
so all the heart of .NET, not the language, the framework.
And very recently, including the language, well, Mads Torgersen, also reports to me, but like he's Mads. I don't actually, I don't have actually influence Mads at all. He's Mads. Mads is Mads. And the language design committee, the language design meeting does its thing and all those people. I don't pretend to influence it anyway, but technically he reports.
But you and Mads have a conversation periodically.
We do, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my part of the world, which means this kind of release, we're here to talk about .NET 9. It's been a lot of, for me, it's been a lot of Aspire, especially because it grows out, that grows out of what I was doing before I started moving into where I am now. Lots of Aspire, lots of kind of AI. There's just kind of two halves of AI for us. It is AI for you and me and us.
As devs,
like co-pilots and friends, AI for code.
Yeah.
And then there's AI for how am I going to, how am I, how, you know, my boss has said he wants a chatbot. How do I make it real? Or how do I integrate AI into my apps? And that's, that bit is more where I play, because then now you need libraries, you need SDKs, you need experiences. How are you going to talk to the LLM? How are you going to do generative AI? Right? How are you going to make it work? We've got lots of samples to do, lots of partners, lots of work. And then our forever goals, right? Security, quality, performance.
Security, a big one. I know. We talked to Dan Roth a few weeks ago, and he was mostly focused on Blazor and the changes to Blazor, but we thought we would get some more breadth about .NET 9 with you.
Yeah.
So we know about Blazor. What are some of the other big wins in .NET 9 over .NET 8?
Let's see. So we've continued our perf journey. We've continued our perf journey, but the thing that I was going to say was in .NET 8, we talked about, I believe it was in 8, maybe even have been as early as 7, but for many years now, we've been on this steady march with native AOT.
Yeah.
As we kind of keep giving you this, more and more of the stack becomes kind of AOTable. We made another good
ahead of
kind
time
of step. That's ahead of time compilation. That's kind of compiling hardest, for lack of a better description, get pilot to native. And what that gives you is, you know, better cold start times, maybe, and things like that, because there's no JIT.
Right.
And what it takes away is dynamicism, right? Like, so if you're in that world, especially if you're in like, I have a small service and I don't need any of the kind of runtime, kind of dynamic runtime features that are difficult in an AOT world, then you might want that extra cold start time on a container on a cluster, right? So we've made more roads towards that. We've made, there's some stuff in the GC. There's the new like dynamic adaptive GC mode for server GC. There is
garbage collection.
Garbage collection. All in support of cloud and building these new workloads and these new ways people are using .NET. Right. Aspire was a kind of big lift that we kind of talked about at the end of .NET 8 at .NET Conf in .NET 8. I did a talk there with Fowler, and then I think you've had Fowler on to talk about it and some people, right?
Sure. And Hunter and Jiaxin.
Yeah. And so
Dan Roth even talked about Aspire.
Yeah, right. And so that shows you the kind of broad thing about Aspire is how many things needed to change.
Yeah. I mean, but I think of it as tooling. You're saying it's in the framework too.
Yes, because Aspire is kind of, it actually crosses almost the entire intersection of the team. Like, it doesn't impact the language, but it impacts almost everything else, right? So you have tooling, yes, because you have the dashboard to give you all your metrics, to give you OTel, to give you that dev-focused, what's going on in my app right now,
right?
Then you have integrations. So integrations were our NuGet packages. They're libraries, the same as all the other things that I build on my team are libraries, right? But they are configured out of the box to assume that you're in this world, you're using cloud stuff might be unreliable, right? We did work in Poly, for example, at the beginning of doing Aspire to help improve its perf, right? Like, we contributed a lot into the Poly project. That was kind of under this umbrella of building this Aspire project. It's gone from elements and ingredients of a stack. Poly is faster. We've got a reduction thing. We've got this ability to, we have baked retries and such in fast better with all these ingredients. Then you start stacking them together until you've got a stack.
Right.
And so now you've got libraries that make it easier to get, you know, I want to talk to Redis, but I need retry. I need a good default retry policy. I need to make sure it's configured with DI properly with the right lifetime. Mm-hmm. Is the Redis client thread safe? I don't know. Is it supposed to be a singleton or not? I got no idea. I could do, you know.
DDI, can you define that?
DI, so dependency injection.
Okay, DI, right.
So if I describe this out, if I pull this out into a list for you, if let's say you're going to use Redis, this is our kind of favorite example, and this was part of our genesis. When we were creating what is Aspire going to be, when we were giving this pitch, we had this slide. And on that slide, it said, if you're going to use Redis today in the modern cloud, this is what you have to do. And it was 15 steps long.
Right. All the configuration settings.
All of the settings, right?
Yeah. Security parameters.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You need to add the NuGet package, right? You got to find the right one. You have to add it to dependency injection in your like server app. What is the lifetime? Don't know. You have to go read the docs, make sure you've got the right one. Because if the thing, you know, can it be a singleton or not is the main decision point, right?
Right.
I've got to add it to DI. Is it logging properly? Is it going to go into my log stream? How do I do that? When we started this effort, that was a shim that you had to do, that you had to go learn.
Right.
That's significantly like improved now, right? Then how do I consume it in my like controller or in my function?
Yeah.
And then like, what is the resiliency policy? Is that turned on? If Redis is a little bit flaky one day or if something happens, is it going to recover? Like it just kept going.
Right. It goes everywhere.
And what we want... it almost becomes viral. And so the intent was, how do you collapse that into just add Redis and for the love of God, make it work with all those things that we just described. So,
well, just give me the settings that would make me happy in the cloud.
Absolutely, right?
Because the bigger thing here is going, hey, what if we did Elastic instead and just being able to switch it? Like if you actually got Redis running right, you'd literally go, okay, don't touch it.
Yeah.
It's working right now.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Well, that brings up another point, which is, if you start with Aspire, right, and you do all the things and you pull all the switches and everything, you add Redis, do you give up the whole idea of adding things manually after Aspire? Like, do you always have to go through the Aspire thing to add things so that you don't disturb?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
if you're going to add another service, can you just add a service and will all the Aspire stuff follow?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you're talking about is the like add Aspire integration, like gesture in tooling.
Well, even if you start with Aspire, but you know, we have many years of manual configuration experience and that's where we go, right? As developers.
Ah, I see.
Do we now have to put that aside and before we add to it or expand our application or applications, do we now look for the Aspire way to do things?
I mean, I hope that the Aspire way means that you can delete some code. And therefore, I'm always supportive of you being able to delete code if that you don't care about or that you don't need to worry about, right?
Yeah.
So that maybe, but no, it's not required for you to go and change the way that you do things, right?
So there isn't any risk of doing something that conflicts with what I've set up in Aspire that maybe I don't even understand, like all that stuff that you said about Redis.
No. So the largest risk is probably that you add a Redis, say, and we built in a particular set of policies with Poly.
Yeah. Poly policies. Yeah.
And then you've wrapped them in your own. And now you've got a double layer of retries or something like that.
Actually, that happened to a customer of mine. We went out and tried to add Aspire to. We already had Poly, right?
Yeah. And so that's probably the biggest risk is you didn't realize that the client you're getting now is already retrying and doing all that for you, and therefore you're doing your own logic for it. That's probably the biggest risk. But ultimately, like, you know, I heard this thing as part of me like being, oh yeah, let me make sure I remember what .NET Rocks is all about. And I listened to Chris Klug, my friend Chris.
Yes.
He was talking about, he talked to you about how he, like, you wouldn't want to be a developer today because of all these things to learn.
You wouldn't want to start.
You wouldn't want to start. You wouldn't want to be getting, you couldn't imagine how overwhelming it must be day one showing up and then them saying, cool, you're building this kind of app, right? So what I'm trying to achieve within Aspire is today I would say that the learning curve for how to build a current app is like logarithmic. It goes like straight up.
Yeah.
And then it starts to even out, right? And you won't want to make it linear. Like, you slowly learn more and more bits and you can make it linear again. Can we flatten this curve of what, how much you need to learn to be productive and to get something that works and can work for real with real internet traffic hitting it and not like fall over
and can be maintained
and can be maintained. Right. Because today it's just this mass. It's very, very hard. Right. And so there's a bunch of interesting challenges.
Because it's not that tough to toss an app service up and get it to run.
Yeah, that's right.
But you haven't done a lot of things at that point.
No, that's right. Yeah. And if you were if you're good with building that kind of app where it's a kind of app service talking to a database, Spire is still useful in that world in that it makes it easy to spin up the database every time you press F5 and stuff like that. But then it's mostly useful when you've got three or four backing APIs or a couple of functions and an API and a database. And then you start to stretch the realms of what app service is kind of really built for in that world, right? That's what that is. So yeah, flattening that curve is super, super important to us. Like one of the customer calls that I did leading into with Spire, I was talking to this engineering lead and we said one of the questions we would ask in our standard script, because we're trying to ask a consistent set of questions, was what's keeping you up at night? Because I'm looking for the answer to that question. Cause if there's something keeping you up at night, I can try and solve it. Right.
Yeah.
And his answer was, I don't know if I'm putting the Lego together properly.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
My app is built on like a pyramid of NuGet packages.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it works, it runs, but are these two supposed to go together? Have I configured this one properly? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much exercise left to me that I am terrified that tomorrow my thing will come crashing down and I don't really know. It's quite possible I put two things together that aren't supposed to go together.
Right.
To your question about Aspire working with other things that I've done, and that's going to cause me something that causes the world to fall apart. And so ultimately you're trying to make it so that that person can go to sleep at night and be like, I'm pretty confident I'm good. I used all the things that they said would work, so that are kind of proven based upon this community and ecosystem of Aspire people building stuff to make it so that I can be more confident that I haven't made that mistake. Right. And that's why in the .NET 9 keynote, I assume hopefully this comes out after the keynote, and I'm not like promoting them. You will have seen is this community toolkit idea with Aspire, which is just the idea of trying to make it so that more and more people can build things that are Aspire components that you can guarantee adhere to the same kind of requirements and guidelines that an Aspire, I'm calling them components still, even though we changed the name to integrations. Because what is an integration? It is effectively, we have this idea of a spec. It means, you know it can wire into dependency injection. You know, there's a set of, 10, 15 things that in order to be an integration, you have to tick. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of Aspire Community Toolkit is you or anybody who has a library that they want to be able to be an Aspire integration can also go and be in the list when you say add Aspire integration. And we'll have a whole community toolkit kind of effort around making sure that we can continue to build up this community of, when you're building this type of app and you really want this kind of guarantees, what do you do and how does it work, right?
Yeah.
It's also still very early in Aspire. There's crazy, crazy stuff we could do, right?
Yeah.
Like Aspire has the model of your entire application. We could map it. We can give you the full description of all the pieces of your app. What's more, you could do things that are crazy. Like some of the people, there's some people on the team I was talking to yesterday who were like, yeah, what if we put a proxy in between every communication section, so on your dev machine, you could turn on packet loss between any individual connection. And you could just make that a feature of the tooling. So you run your app and you turn on packet loss, right? Or things like that, right? That's possible to do today, but do developers go to the effort of figuring out how to do it and turn it on? Like, probably not. But if it was just there and you just had to click a thing,
you may as well try it, right?
So there's a lot of that kind of work that you can do in the Aspire space, just to try and help people make their apps more reliable from the beginning, so they're not like called up in the middle of the night or anything crazy like that.
Well, not finding out the hard way that it isn't reliable.
Not finding out the hard way. We had a lot of horror stories of people finding out the hard way, and we tried to fix all of those things for those people when we were building up.
You don't find out you're logging wrong until you're eating it, and then you go looking for the logs and can't find them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's when you find out you've been logging wrong.
How do we fix that? Right.
It's been a year.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you talked about Aspire the first time at .NET Conf for .NET 8.
Indeed.
And we did our first show with Fowler, I think, January of 24. So are we on, is this V2 or is this really V1? Like, it felt like you were just experimenting a year ago.
Isn't the common Microsoft saying that the V2 is when you start trying it? Isn't that what people used to say? Is that V3 now?
And V3 is when it's great. Yeah.
V3 is the golden version. Yeah.
The golden version. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you had a year of feedback and pressing against this. I mean, so, we're in a GitHub world now, right?
Yeah,
I've watched the issues. It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, that was the goal, was to get that, what are the themes, I think, is part of this discussion now, which is like, what are you done? What have customers hit real badly? So one of the biggest things that we, that people hit a lot that we've started to try to address is just, so we had this concept of developer first, ops friendly that I used to talk about with the team. Cause like, you can't, like, this thing has to fit into that world.
Right.
And like, and if you super prioritize towards only the developer, you're like, sysadmin guy is going to be,
the ops guys,
what is this? Like, no, you can't do this. Right.
Yeah.
And so you needed to build a solution that is attractive and productive and good for developers, but then lets you easily fit into the flow that those sysadmin folks want.
Yeah.
So it was very obvious to us almost immediately, once people started to use this thing, that people desperately wanted more ability to customize what the thing that they were deploying to when they were using the kind of default deployments. We should probably talk about deployments more generically, but when using the like AZD experience specifically, they wanted something more. So this is the interesting thing about Aspire is AZD is not mine, but another principle that we had was kind of extreme ownership. This idea that within Aspire, at least, we were not going to let the gaps between the different parts of the things that we needed to work for you to be successful stop us from making changes.
Right.
So if the AZD team needed to do something to make the Azure thing good, or even the AWS team needed to do something to make the AWS experience good, we would go talk to them and we would try and figure it out, right?
Right.
In terms of deployment. So one of the big things with Azure Container Apps and Aspire and doing AZD app was, well, how do I change the name of the thing, or like tweak this one setting, or the SQL thing is real good except this bit. And I don't want to have to completely eject from the system. So you could always generate all of the bicep and then you hand that off and then involve it from there, check it in. But I don't want to do that. If I could avoid it, can you give me something else? And so now there's a lot more flexibility in you being able to drop into effectively a C# wrapper around what the bicep generated would be within AZD. Mm-hmm. So you can tweak names, you can change settings that you previously would have had to fully eject into, generate the bicep, check it in, and then use bicep from then on. And so there's a lot more of now you can kind of pick the right spectrum to be able to fit that. Then there was a lot of people who desperately wanted like wait for. So I can say, I want this to start after this thing.
Yeah, right.
So now you've got support for that. You have support for persistent containers to keep the SQL server running in between the executions of my app. So we now have support for that. All of these things were all really driven from people who were using the thing and saying, yeah, we need this support, right? As well as a few like big internal people who were using it. You would have seen a video in the keynote, if you watched it, from one of the architects who works on Copilot. The unified like backend for Copilots is built using Aspire. And so whenever you're using one of the Microsoft Copilots, it all go through this same kind of Copilot backend. That's an Aspire like backend API set that is orchestrated, and their dev loop uses Aspire, right? It doesn't impact their production.
And Glenn, I'm going to interrupt you for one moment for these very important messages.
Is your on-prem .NET framework application a prisoner? Find freedom on AWS with Elastic Scale and pay-as-you-go pricing. Port to cross-platform .NET and run on Linux without license fees. Find out more at aws.amazon.com/.net/modernize. Hey, Carl here. Today we're spotlighting a tool that's turning heads in the tech community. Raygun's AI Error Resolution brings you smart AI-powered insights directly into your development workflow. This feature doesn't just identify errors, it suggests how to fix them quickly and efficiently in seconds. If you're ready for a deeper dive into smarter debugging, You won't want to miss what Raygun has to offer. Visit raygun.com/.netrocks. That's Raygun, raygun.com/.netrocks for your free 14-day trial to explore the way Raygun is revolutionizing debugging.
And we're back. It's .NET Rocks. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Carl Franklin.
Hey, hey, hey.
Talking to our friend Glenn Condron about all the .NET 9 goodness.
Indeed. Welcome back.
Plenty of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just a reminder that you can get an ad-free feed of .NET Rocks by becoming a $5 a month patron at patreon.dotnetrocks.com. Okay. You were saying, Glenn.
I don't remember. That was out. something about we had a lot. I think my pain point was there was lots of feedback. We did a lot of features. I highlighted some of them.
Yeah.
But it was all trying to just, our goal was between when we kind of shipped halfway through .NET 9 to now was all about top pain point fix, top pain point. Lock them down. .NET 8, I meant, yeah. So that's what it's been. And now we're in this, what I think is a really nice state. We have a lot of people who are using it for real, and that's and we're
getting
that prioritization.
The thing that piqued my interest when you were talking about drop into a C-sharp wrapper around stuff that you don't really understand or need to learn now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. This ability.
So that's all part of Aspire. That's not something that's available to .NET developers without Aspire. Or
It will be available to. It should be available to .NET developers elsewhere because it's not technically part of Aspire. It's just it's a feature of the Azure Developer, the AZD CLI, and the AZD experience. We give you a method, and we make it intuitive when you're within Aspire. But it's not. We layer the software better. Layer and kind of segment the software better than that, right? So you should also be able to get that outside of the Aspire experience.
Love that.
Aspire is very much a collection of pieces that all work fine on their own,
right?
But get better when you put them all together, right? Yeah. So the dashboard that shows you all your OTel data, it's just an OTel dashboard. Mm. You can make anything that talks OTel appear in that thing. It doesn't need to
be Aspire. Telemetry.
Open telemetry in this case.
I'm the acronym, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. And if you'll notice, if you go to Azure Container Apps now, they have the dashboard. The Aspire dashboard.
Right.
Because it's just code. They just took it and hosted it at ACA and said, hey, this is a cool OTel endpoint. Let's put it in there, right? Integrations are just NuGet packages.
Mm.
The ad integration for gesture in Visual Studio is literally a search on NuGet for things that are owned by the Aspire account. Like there's nothing special about them. They're a NuGet package with some wire up code. Right. Wow. The kind of way the service discovery-ish stuff is environment variables, right? Like it is very much you could do all of this stuff today. You could have done all of the things that Aspire does for you.
Right.
But it puts it all together for you so you don't have to think about it as much. And
yeah, it's the classic thing of, you want to use this library or whatever, this component that might be an open source component or whatever. First you download the NuGet package, then you wire it up in program CS, and then you might have to add a CSS file or JavaScript link or all of that stuff.
Yeah. And so how do we help you get there? That's kind of a lot of what it does.
Yeah.
But when you put it all together, the experience of all those things together is kind of mind blowing. People look at it and say, I'm like, where has this been all my life? And
real powerful effect, right? Like that's the whole thing.
Indeed. A very powerful cumulative effect when you put all these pieces together, but they're all individually adoptable and they're not super tightly coupled, which is very nice.
And more importantly, if you've got strong opinions about how you want your cloud native apps to be built, you can take the pieces out that don't work for your plan
or change them.
But I appreciate that. And so it's still early days, but clearly you guys have been taking a lot of feedback. Like just look at the issues list.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I haven't had time to triage this yet, but I imagine you do this. How much of these issues are people don't understand how to use this versus people want to take it further?
So there is a lot of, there's not as many issues for I don't understand how to do this, but there's lots of discussion, right? Yeah. So the feedback channels are filled with, yeah, but what is it?
Yeah.
Right? They're filled with, yeah, but what is it?
I think building an app with Aspire would be a great learning opportunity for somebody who has never done Redis, right? And instead of, going to the documentation, spending a whole day or two reading it and trying to figure out how to cram it into your app, you use Aspire and then you go and look and see what it did.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, that makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is good in that regard. And that's partly because of that effort to try to kind of make learning linear again. Right.
Yeah. And to smooth these things out, give us the pit of success here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That if you just follow the defaults, you're going to be in a good place. And if you want to go further, you can.
Right. And then it helps your bigger enterprises, because the bigger enterprise wants to try and get some level of consistency across 20 teams. So now you've got that lever as well.
You can really press against those templates and make it the way you want it to be. I don't want to do a whole show on Aspire because there's more stuff going on in .NET 9. Let's do the AI conversation.
Right. That sounds good.
It's kind of on the radar for a lot of folks these days.
For a lot of people, yeah. So one of the big things, the first call out I think I would say on that front is if you haven't looked at Sanderson's kind of sample apps, in 8 we talked about eShop. We did this kind of rework of the eShop sample app, make it all cloudified. It's running with Aspire and stuff like that, right? So as one of the engineers on our team said, we're now expanding the eShop cinematic universe to create this eShop back of house application, which is imagine that you were the like support person having to deal with customer support for that eShop kind of app.
Right.
We built that app. And so it uses a lot of AI in ways that sometimes are convincing, are sometimes not as obvious to people because every AI demo you've ever seen is how do I chat?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Sure.
And so it uses it for filtering. It uses it for summarization. It uses it to like help me make sure I'm looking at the most important issue, help me find the right, when I get the feedback ticket that where I want to respond with RTFM, read the manual with an F in the middle. Mm-hmm. How do I ask the AI to find the bit in the manual that I should link them to so that I don't have to go search through the manual? Like things, all those sort of functionality exists in that sample app, and it's all put together and it's working well, and Sanderson's done some talks on it, and Sanderson's a great presenter, so like I'm sure you will.
I grabbed the link to his video from Aspire Days.
So
that thing's amazing.
It absolutely is. So watch all of that, especially if you're like, yeah, but why do I care about AI if I don't work in an app where I need a chatbot, so what could I do? Look at some of his stuff. It is very good.
It's inspirational for thinking more broadly about what these tools can do for you.
Absolutely, right? So then in support of that, so what does the .NET team do? What does my team do? Mm-hmm. So we have this way, we have started with effectively primitives. We're looking at, okay, you need to tokenize strings in this world. What's the fastest, best, most pop? What's the best tokenizer that everybody in the world should use? Let's make sure an implementation of that exists. Like these very bare, like numerics, like these very, very low level underlying primitives that build a bunch of this stuff. And then effectively, we just start building up as we build building blocks and building blocks and building blocks that allow you to do to communicate with to do this generative AI task. I don't want to say communicate with, right? So in the .NET ecosystem, you have Semantic Kernel and you have Azure SDKs. You have all the like these libraries to be able to do kind of generative AI stuff. We help and support all of those things. And then we look at, okay, well, what is the underpinning that we should be building that all of these people need? And this is the forever question. What is the thing we should build so that they don't have to, and then everybody will adopt it, and then everybody will be in a better place. So that's where we've been going. So one of the things you'll see in .NET 9 is this extensions AI. We talked about it a bit beforehand. Yeah. It's Semantic Kernel already exists, and then extensions AI is this kind of building block layer for, I want to talk to an LLM. And what that library set allows you to do is do kind of a chat completion, which is what a lot of the stuff, even the stuff that isn't chat, kind of boils down to. I'm going to send a string to a server. I'm going to get a string back. I'm going to figure out what it means. Mm-hmm. And I want to do the stuff where I teach that about my own data, and I want to have telemetry plugged in and such. And it gives you a consistent abstraction over many different types of LLMs. So if you're going to use OpenAI, or you're going to use some local thing, or you're going to use like Ollama, or you're going to use, you can have the same programming experience against a bunch of different models that can all plug into the system. What's interesting about it is it effectively uses a middleware pipeline. So the same as ASP.NET Core middleware, for those of you playing along at home. So you make a request effectively in this world, which is a chat completion, and it goes through this middleware pipeline. And so that moves implementation of things like logging out of the provider that is specific to the LLM and into the generic
library such that every provider doesn't have to do all the logging stuff.
Right,
so you as a consumer get consistent logging. You get consistent tool calling where one of the things LLMs will do is call your methods if they need to, right? It has all of that sort of stuff built into this middleware layer as opposed to being each provider. That makes it easier to write providers. That hopefully means we get more providers. It also allows other things like semantic kernel to like layer on top and get those same benefits. Right.
Do you foresee people using AI for things we typically code forms over data for? Like, I'll give you an example. Selecting a report, right, with a whole bunch of filters. Instead of having drop-down combo boxes and things that fill and refill and check boxes and whatever, would you foresee somebody just opening a text box and say, give me all this data between this date and that date with this, you know, particular filter and blah, 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 and replace all of that UI code?
Yeah, seems entirely likely that would happen. I think what will happen first is that you'll use AI to build that form that you just described.
Hmm.
First step, right? Copilots and friends and all of the tooling in Visual Studio Code. Like, right. You even see, like, you see the explosion of AI-assisted coding, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So the first step one would be, I want to build that form. And then the AI says, sure, here's all the UI.
Right.
The second part would be, yeah, I think you could get to that point. Would it be faster? Would it be better for the end consumer? I'm not 100% sure, right?
Like, well, at least giving them the option, right?
Giving the option, I think, will absolutely happen. Will it be? But I still suspect you'll have your kind of, you'll still want your thing that is the thing everybody looks at. We already know what it is. Right, so let's like make it real I don't have to chat. Because I think that process will involve some iteration to get exactly what you want every time. Right. So you won't want to do that for the report you have to look at every second day, right?
Yeah. And then on top of that, you could add speech recognition so that you could literally talk to the app and get
absolutely
what you want out of it.
Yeah. But more important, but more also interesting to that is just mining for insights, right? Like if you're going to have that conversational way where the thing can understand all of the data, can you ask it questions just like, you know, what has my growth been? What is my year over year growth now?
Absolutely.
And it would just tell you. And then you don't need to go look at the chart to interpret what the year over year growth is, right?
So to give you a percentage. You might have an app, which is your main app, and then you might have this AI bot, for lack of a better thing, that you just converse with to get data out of your back end.
Yeah. And then you see the other experiments people have gotten where you're effectively getting a free junior dev of like, which is just AI agents writing, like doing PRs for you against issues that are logged on your repo. Right. That's insane.
Well, at least writing my PR comment, like, good Lord.
Yeah, absolutely.
Its ability to actually remember, well, not remember, but analyze everything I've changed and give me a summary of it.
Give me a summary.
It's not in my head.
Fantastic. Write all the unit tests for me, right? Like, ultimately, you want to get to a point on that AI assistance where the AI is doing all the toil of code so that you could do the fun parts, right?
They're augmentation tools and they're a good one. It writes unit tests that are okay, but you know, it's still easier to edit a test than it is to write them from scratch.
Right.
And sometimes it spits out stuff you just haven't thought of.
Absolutely. What's interesting for me, like, I guess I want to talk about challenges that are maybe unique to me on this front and maybe not, but hopefully it's interesting to people, is like, you can't put that stuff in a box that ships annually yet.
Yeah.
Because it's there's this challenge within the AI space. It's within Aspire as well. They're just different. So I guess it's common for both of those things, but for different reasons. But both of those areas are resistant to, we're going to ship it once every year and call it good and put it and install it on everybody's machine. Either because the pace is really fast or because you're dependent on lots of stuff that you don't control. In the case of Aspire, right? If we need to update the Redis client that we depend upon, we'll need to do an update, right? And in the AI's case, there might be some new way of doing something that is very important. Therefore, both of them are kind of not, we're shipping them along with everything else in .NET 9, but we're making sure that mechanically they're not tied to shipping, only being able to ship when we ship a major version of the thing.
Mm, sure. And you need to be able to swap out what OpenAI library you're using.
Absolutely.
I would hope you can switch to a local instance of Claude if you want, or Llama, right? Like, Yeah, that's
all that sort of stuff. Yeah, but then also like, and what's interesting about that is, Aspire 9 works on .NET 8.
Right.
But like normally we have for some time tried to keep 9 is 9, 8 is 8, 7 is 7, because it's just easier. It's far easier to reason about, right? Yeah. Everybody's brain breaks when you start saying, but technically you could be using version 7 of this on version 6 of that with version 4 of this thing over here, and then your brain explodes.
Right. Yeah, where I kind of feel like one version of Aspire is good.
And that's right. And so, yeah, so, but if it's two versions, if it's Aspire 8 as a world and Aspire 9 as a world, and they're working on a .NET version, which is either .NET 8 or .NET 9, that's probably understandable. But that's part of this, like, that the things I don't necessarily always ship in the box now, same as with kind of extensions AI. And that's, we can't go to the world where everything individually ships, because we tried that. In the early days of Core, if any of you remember.
I do, and that was a battle. But I also think .NET 8 is LTS. Like, it makes sense to me you'd support two versions of .NET.
Indeed, which is another discussion that you then have internally about, oh, maybe this makes a lot of sense. Maybe we should do this more. We haven't made decisions on those front, but we've certainly talked about it. Yeah.
No, but you're definitely feeling around for it. Some things you just want to keep synced. Like, I'm okay with you calling it Aspire 9.
Yeah.
Even though there's no way you've made 9 versions of anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though there's no 8 versions. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because it's just, you've got to try and you have to balance the, well, technically these things can all be independent versus, but how should people think about it? Because you need to make it easy for everybody at the keyboard trying to figure out what they got to do. You need to balance all of the, that, you got to balance that thing. And then, but it's easy to invent scenarios of like, but what if we add a thing here, a bug fix to this package only, and somebody really wants that? And we're like, yeah, but really?
Mm. Well, and especially in fast iterating stuff, there should only be one current version of Aspire that does. I don't care what you're working on the back end, it works.
Yeah, ideally.
And same for all of this Gen AI stuff, because it is so iterating so rapidly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then for in the AI stuff, the challenge is figuring out the things that are going to be enduring.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to push everything down, right? So we have chat completions in, and some people will look at that and say, yeah, that's cute. Like, but what about this other like mountain of stuff that exists in that ecosystem? Like, what about audio? What about streaming audio backwards and forwards, or like some other thing, right? And we'll be like, but we can't move. Different layers of .NET can move at different speeds, and we don't help anybody if we evolve too fast in the library in the extensions AI space.
Well, some folks are arguing that a version of .NET every year is too fast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But that's already too fast for some people, right?
Yeah.
I think with that, it's actually often more about people when people don't want to feel forced to move.
Yeah.
More than they care about the fact that there's another version, and people feel bad if the versions get too far ahead of them when you're stuck on too old a version.
Which is all entirely reasonable. If you're still hanging on .NET 6, you're missing out.
Yeah, lots of people are on .NET 6, by the way. Yeah. It's our most popular, not new. It's our most popular version.
Because it's the older LTS.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So the data tells us that roughly half of the .NET base only moved from LTS to LTS. That's fine.
That's good. That's a good thing to know.
Yeah.
And it just speaks to people care about that. Like, there's another debate that says, why have an LTS and a non-LTS? Like, just make them all the same.
Yeah.
But clearly it matters to a certain group of folks.
It does. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I included a link to Stephen Taub's every year amazing, ridiculously complicated
test.
You know, you need to spend an afternoon reading blog post on performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm firmly in the camp of when you switch to a newer version of .NET, stuff's faster.
Yeah,
you just no two ways about it.
Yeah. For everybody listening, every version is faster.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a truism.
Full stop.
Yeah. we try to make every version faster. And there's some amazing experiments happening. The runtime team has been experimenting with async and like a different version of async. Like,
oh wow,
version?
Like, not a different version. Like, we're not going to change the way
async different works. Approach.
Different approach.
Okay.
What if async was more of a runtime feature and less of a compiler feature?
Interesting.
Yeah. What does it do to perf?
Yeah.
What scenarios are better? What scenarios are worst, right? Like, what does that look like?
Rather than just spitting out async IL with all of its overhead, what if you actually had underpinnings in the OS that, indeed, or underpinnings in the language, right, that did this?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, like, experiments for that, like, it grew growing out of, you know, you maybe you saw some of our experimentation with green threads, and does it make sense to have a green thread model in .NET? The outcome of that was, yes, we could do this, but it would like be yet another way of doing async. Do we really want to add yet another one that doesn't have a significant enough benefit?
What are green threads? What's that?
It's they're kind of like the way that Go routines in Go work. It's just a different way of doing async. It's a bit far from the point to worry about it.
Sure.
We can grab a link. But what we'll do is grab a link to the
original issue called the Green Thread Experiments.
Right, yeah, cool. Exactly.
Good. Yeah. Cool.
It's a good, interesting read if you care about learning what is green threads or about just this topic in general. But to be honest, something that most of y'all probably don't have to care about. So,
So I want to just go back before we sign off here. You were talking about AOT and how AOT is progressing. Our friend Dylan Beatty, we just talked to, I think last week before this comes out, right, Richard?
Something like that. Yeah. Dylan.
He's great.
Yeah. All right. So he has a language called Rockstar, and you know,
of course, it's
fun.
Yeah.
But he was waiting for AOT to really come into its own, and he was like, .NET 8 finally delivered, so he can, you know, with a GitHub action, produce a fully, you know, native version of his interactions, the compiler, whatever you want to call it, for all platforms. And so that's there in .NET 8. In .NET 9, does it just make faster and smaller executables or what?
No. So it's more of the AOT at this point is the more of the ecosystem just works. So like in 8, AF doesn't really work, right? AF does a lot of things that don't work super great in AOT. So if you're trying to do a compiler, it's 100% fine. Some parts of the stack don't necessarily work super well with it. And so it's more about broadening the ecosystem so that more and more of the things just work without you thinking about it is what the progression for AOT is for at least the next year or two or three.
Okay.
Good. Yeah. In the context of AOT, just as another subject before we run out of time, Windows on ARM.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my presumption has always been, you guys are going to take care of this for us as .NET developers. If you want to run on ARM, you run on ARM. And JIT will simply do it.
Yeah, the magic of JIT. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But if you're AOTing, do you have to pick a platform?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you're and the obvious one is x64.
Indeed.
Because that's what everybody's running. So, that makes life pretty easy. And then flip an ARM shows up. And you're like,
and then now you've got to do a new build. You need a new compile. You need a new compilation for the new platform that is targeted for that thing.
And that's the price of AOT.
That's the price. Yeah. One of the prices. Yeah. Absolutely. But if you're a compiler, you probably want that.
Yeah.
And
well, and if you are deploying a backend chunk of code that needs to be absolutely as fast as possible and only runs in exactly one place, a specific, you know, instance in Azure, you can AOT that thing.
Also, if you're running in a container, and where you have a lot of control over this thing, you might very well always specify a lot of that platform information, so you know it's never going to change.
Right.
But to your point, to some extent, you're still running on a CPU. Like, what are you?
Yeah, you are. And that's just the job of the runtime was to, and the CLR was to take care of this for us.
Yeah, indeed.
It is interesting to think, because they are starting to roll out those big Maya ARM processors into Azure now, that it's one thing for me to build in .NET and run it in a regular app service or then run it on a Linux instance. But now I'd have the option to run it as an ARM instance and say, you know, that it's like 20%, 25% cheaper to run it on a Linux instance. I wonder what it's going to be on an ARM instance. Much less performance.
Indeed. Don't know yet.
Don't know yet.
Yes, if you're using normal .NET, then we got you.
Yeah, you know it's going to work. It's just like, the simpler architecture of ARM, the way that it processes instructions, and I am clearly a hardware geek, I wonder if it'll actually outperform and be cheaper from a resource consumption perspective. But you guys also haven't had as much time to optimize for ARM yet. Like maybe another version or two from now, your ARM optimizations will be stunning.
And it might well be that that's the thing that makes the perf changes in from version to version in the future. Who knows, right?
Yeah, and jumps out again, right? It's like, hey, you want this thing to rock? Run it on an ARM instance in Azure.
I still can't get out of the mindset that, well, I will, but that ARM, it means lower power, right?
That is,
but isn't that is totally changed? Isn't the MacBook M2 kind of stuff? Isn't that an ARM chip?
Well, they're up to M4 now, and yes, I would say highest performance setup that exists right now.
But yeah,
that's because it's this super ASIC, right? Like it's the processor and the GPU and the and the NPU and like everything integrated on this chip of doom, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's where they're getting a lot of their wins, and that's what
used to be
Snapdragon did with their Ultra X, right? That's this new Windows on ARM platform.
Yeah. Yeah,
is that processor.
Yeah, this is, and this is part of the world that I don't spend as much time in, but the assembly, when you start looking at the assembly that is getting generated when against x86 or versus ARM versus ARMv2 and such,
because
like the ARM instruction set is getting fairly large, but like there's some cool stuff. I've watched some people recently where you decompile it. If you use like one of the tools to do decompilation, and you put like x86 versus ARM, and then you take the same code and you look at what the assembly looks at, it's vastly different. And frequently, looks way simpler on ARM than it did on x86.
You know, x64, x86 has this baggage of decades.
Yep.
You know, that it's bridged from 8-bit to 16-bit to 32-bit to 64-bit.
Mm-hmm.
And ARM has only been 32 or 64. Like, they're just fundamentally simpler. And, you know, to the point where that Snapdragon machine is emulating x64 fast enough that you barely notice it. It's more power consumptive, but it's fast.
Yeah, for some of the people out there who are interested in this, you should absolutely, well, first of all, Tobe and Hanselman do some deep.net where they drop to assembly, I believe. You should probably watch some of that. But also just jump into some of the decompiler apps that are out there. It's write something basic. Do a console.writeline and then go look at the IL. But then start clicking around and look at some of the assembly, not to try and understand it, just to like have a look and see how it goes. Yeah. And if you do want to learn that layer of the stack, like go nuts. It's so easy. It's not easy. It is so available now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For you, if you want to choose to go into that part of the stack to go do it, like you can do that now. It was kind of impossible for a long time for you to really figure that stuff out. And now there's lots more resources available. There's lots of very easy tools to just write some code, see what the output would be look like. Last weekend I spent 2 hours and I had a basic app. I had a basic OS writing to the console, right? Like I had created a Grub bootloader that like booted an emulator in QEMU and like was writing hello world to the screen. Right. That was like, I could follow a tutorial on the internet to get to the point where I was booting hardware. That's insane. And it's amazing.
It's crazy.
Like, doesn't matter which part of the computing world that you want to be involved in right now, the availability of materials is ridiculous. So even though we said earlier that it would be scary and horror and maybe I wouldn't want to be a new developer these days, on the other hand, man, how much more stuff is available for me to learn if I'm a new developer these days?
And so much more to do, but this is where the tooling comes into play.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, 2 years ago, building cloud native in .NET, hard.
Yeah.
Right. Aspire may be young, but it's easier now.
Yep.
Absolutely. And it'll only get easier from here.
Yeah. This is the advantage of kind of .NET as a platform, right? Is because you have us, my team, constantly looking at what sort of apps does everybody have to build? How do we make that as easy to possible? And then as .NET evolves, the type of apps you need to build, chances are we've been making that easier for a bit for you, or at least we will be in a year from now.
Yeah.
It's one of the challenges I try to set for myself and for my team is that constant progression of what does modern mean?
Yeah.
Right. We're like, if I am going to Greenfields project today and I'm like, yes, this time we're going to do it right. then what would I think I would build?
Yeah.
And how do I make that thing that you're trying to build be amazing?
Yeah.
Without letting the people who don't get the chance to do that Greenfields fall by the wayside. Right. Cause you also need it's often far more impactful for me to help the person who needs to get to that different architecture.
But I think you have to do this in two steps. First is, what's the perfect greenfield implementation? And then how do I allow these tools to bridge my brownfield app to that space?
Exactly. Yeah. And you see Aspire trying to bridge that world now.
Yeah, but you're doing that.
A couple of years ago, we didn't know what the ideal greenfield space is, right?
Yeah.
You can, and there's still like lots of areas to go look at in this whole space.
Cool. Well, Glenn, what's next for you after .NET 9? What's in your inbox?
I think 10 is the next number after 9.
you know, I had a feeling you'd say
it's weird.
Yeah, it's funny.
What a thing.
Are you gonna like take a vacation or something before you jump back in? Or
typically December gets pretty quiet on the .NET team.
Yeah, sure.
Towards the end of November and December.
And I gotta bet there's a bunch of stuff that's sitting in like a vNext hopper that didn't make it.
There is. So there's a lot of teams. There's a lot of people who are now going through their backlogs. So there's a lot of backlog grooming happening at the moment. Like, what are the things we want to pop? We want to pop that we want to bring up in the next version. Aspire needs to do like some miners before 10. So it'll do some like backwards compatible, like let's throw a few brand new features in here. Like, we just ship support for big areas like functions and friends. So they'll have to ship, and they'll have to ship before the next version.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of which of these experiments do we now want to bring forward? Which of them do we want? A lot of those kinds of decisions have to be made. And then
there's some gotchas in Blazor that need addressing.
There is a lot of work on all of the like platforms, right? Yeah. They just all need constant evolution and constant love to make better. Maui has gotten way better. Blazor is significantly getting better. But Blazor, in practice, only very recently kind of switched into this full stack kind of almost meta framework mode of being a web stack. So like, there's a lot of work there. There's we've been talking a lot about reliability of connections within Blazor and trying to make sure circuits and connections and stuff are much more reliable and resilient, and what work we can do there, for example. Like, as well as a whole backlog of stuff that team has. Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen in AI 6 months from now that people are going to need to use. Like, I need people, like I need big companies who are today knocking on my door saying, we've got a fleet of .NET applications and we want them to be using this new generative AI stuff today.
Right.
What do you got? So I need to figure out how to answer those people.
Yeah.
And then all of that sort of stuff. Like, every week is different.
These are pretty cool problems, Glenn. Actually.
Yeah, they are cool.
I mean, they're still problems, but they're cool.
I have a cool job. Don't get me wrong. not many other jobs where I get to listen to somebody talk to me about like a GC and like runtime, like async stuff, as well as AI and like how we're going to do cloud native stuff, and all in 1 week, right? Is like all the spectrums of the stack.
It's all good stuff. Glenn Condren, thank you for spending this time with us. And wow, what a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Hopefully it was enjoyable to everybody out there. And I'll see you all next time.
All right. And we'll talk to you, dear listener, next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by Plop Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time. Got a transmitter banned by the FCC. Yes, I'm a toy boy. Life is hard. Pay my taxes with my credit card.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. Everybody needs some variety in life. That's what I love about Chumba Casino. They know how to keep things fresh and exciting. All their games are free to play, like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire. You can claim free daily login bonuses too. And they release new games every week. So spice things up with ChumbaCasino.com now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian,
At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's BARTESIAN.com/cocktail.